Session number 12708. It's R.W. Hawksworth, reel 12.
Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 12. A pretty humdrum existence, Mr. Hawksworth. Did that give any disciplinary problems?
Well, there were the usual minor crimes committed. People failing to report back on time, having been out during the day, etc. I myself, must admit, was involved in a rather serious misdemeanour during our stay on the island, which I will briefly relate upon. At one time, the higher authority had decided that a battalion commando-style raid could be organised on the port of Sfax on the Algerian coast. Two companies to Sfax and possibly the other two companies to a place called Sousse. Sousse will be embarked upon Royal Naval aircraft, etc. And to this end, we increased our section training in the space available, and ultimately we were made battle ready and issued with an item of food called an emergency ration, which is about the size of a large sardine tin and contains a high protein form of chocolate, which is guaranteed to sustain a person for 1 week. This claim, I must admit, leaves me in much doubt. However, towards the final date, of which we knew nothing, a decision was made to cancel the intending raid, much to our relief, I might add, and back to square one order was decided upon, including the return of the emergency rations, which hitherto had been issued to the individuals who would have embarked. I being one of them, a stretcher bearer attached at that time to A Company. When the colour sergeant paraded the men and demanded the return of the tins containing emergency rations later during the day, it was found that several of these tins were found to contain not the original contents but the equivalent weight in sand. Needless to say, this caused a great furore, and everyone was once more paraded, and the remaining few of us who had not handed in our emergency rations were instructed so to do. This was done, and I, along with several others, were accused of disposing illegally of the original contents and substituting an equivalent weight in sand. Resultantly, I was tried before the company commander, who himself decided that this offence was too serious for him to dispose of, and so I was remanded for the commanding officer. And I and these few others were duly arraigned before the commanding officer, Colonel John Kirby, and asked if we would accept his award and the matter of punishment. Several did so and were awarded 28 days field punishment, and I refused, insisting upon my innocence, saying I knew nothing of this, and if it had been replaced with sand, then it had been someone else's doing. Having refused commanding officer's punishment, I was therefore put by for a future court-martial and placed in close arrest. In a tent, surrounded by orange trees in full fruit, and so I was at least not hungry for the rest of my stay in close arrest. Subsequently, the court-martial was formed, and I was taken before the prosecuting officer. I had great difficulty in obtaining the assistance of a defending officer. For some obscure reason, there were none available until 2 days before the court-martial. I was duly found guilty of illegally disposing of the original contents and sentenced to 3 months' detention, which would be carried out at our local detention centre, organised by our own battalion. While awaiting promulgation of this sentence of 3 months detention, I was once more placed back in close arrest, as is proper procedure. News came through 3 days later, however, from the provost sounds, who informed me that I would stay where I bloody well was, you bloody nuisance, because the brigadier refused to promulgate the sentence. This interested me. Being still a reasonably young soldier, I hardly knew what the word promulgation meant, and nor did I understand why the brigadier hadn't thrown it out rather than send it back. It later transpired at my second court-martial, which had been allowed, that hearsay evidence was admitted. I've later since learned that this was not to be allowed. However, this evidence was put forward by a colour sergeant involved, and I was subsequently placed in the detention centre to carry out the original sentence. Once more, this was disputed and commuted to 23 days, having spent the previous time in close arrest. It in itself was an experience. I wasn't locked up with a gang of crooks. Some of the battalion comedians were actually penned in this small enclosure, and one of our expeditions included slinking out one night and stealing half the battalion's rations, which we hung up in the trees surrounding our prison and consumed at our leisure later. This caused not a little confusion. I've since admitted to this in certain quarters. It caused quite a laugh. On my release, I must explain that I was the first prisoner to be put inside the stockade who didn't have his hair shorn.
What was life like in the stockade? What time of the day did you rise, for example?
We were got out of bed a half an hour before the battalion, and various tasks were...
What time would that be?
5 o'clock. 5 a.m. we were up. Some of us would be sent out on working parties on the airfield under close supervision. I was engaged in assisting to dig a subterranean headquarters under a local building, Takali. There were, I think, 16 of us altogether. Various other jobs were done within the confines of the Italian area. Strange enough, if anything, I did not only gain in stature, but in strength, because as a result of our doing extra work, we also got an additional extra ration.
It wasn't a particularly cruel task. They didn't keep...
No, far from it. It was not run as a penal settlement or a local prison. It was a period of confinement. The thing which hurt me most, because I was a freedom-loving type, although I didn't used to bother to go out very much. The thing that irked me from the first day until I came out was the fact that I was confined against my wishes. Although, as the more learned inmates who'd previously occupied these premises under similar circumstances said, you'll soon get over it and you'll be back in again.
Were you fed on the same ration as the rest of the men?
Oh, yes, exactly, yes.
Being under close arrest, what does that exactly mean?
A person is usually placed in close arrest for committing an offence for which has not yet been tried and judged and punished, mainly supposedly for his own security, in case he decides to commit further felonies whilst awaiting trial. He is not allowed out of his close confinement, whether it be a tent or a room or a barrack building. Certainly not the barrack area.
And were the guards on the entrances?
In my case, no. There was no one there at all. I could have walked out any time at all. My absence would have been noted eventually, but there was no. I didn't have a sentry outside or anything like that.
What was the upshot of all this at the end of it, when you did come out?
When I'd completed my 23-day confinement, the punishment awarded by the court-martial, I was immediately sent for by the regimental sergeant major, George Flanagan, a close friend of my uncle, who at one time had served in the battalion, who lectured me as a father might and told me that for far too long I've been sitting my arse at a stretcher bed doing little or nothing, and it's time I started doing a bit of soldiering and getting a stripe on my arm. I was then sent to my company, which was headquarter company still, and assisted the company clerk until the decision was made about my future. About that time, a weapon training course had been arranged for the battalion, and that my name was put forward, along with Private Temple and Milligan, who I previously mentioned. At the end of the three-week course, we came top of the course. I was second. Subsequently, decision was made to transfer me to a rifle company, a combat company, whilst Temple and Milligan went back to sit on their asses in the quartermaster stores. I realised then that my future had been well planned. I finished up in C Company with a corporal instructor who'd been on the course, Corporal Fishwick, and rapidly became promoted Lance Corporal. And Corporal Fishwick and I became extremely firm friends, which lasted until the Italian campaign, when I had to leave for home. So all in all, as it turned out, my short spell as a criminal served a good purpose.
Weapon training, what weapons were you training on, or training with?
All infantry weapons. There was a certain amount of drill, but basically it was an intensive course on all weapons, and the maintenance, the use of, small arms theory appertaining to these things. We were at that time armed with Thompson machine guns for close quarter fighting. The Sten gun hadn't reached it by that time. The ordinary rifleman's rifle, the 2-inch mortar, and pistols, anything that fired and was equipped by our battalion, we were taught and had an intensive course upon. At the end of courses, which is the usual system, we were given an examination paper, an oral test, and a practical test, and I came through with flying colours.
Did this increase your pay?
No, but later, not long after, of course, when I became a Lance Corporal, this did. I think it was 6 months a day extra, a vast sum in those days.
Of those weapons, which were at least growing in some variety since the war had started, what were they like? Which was had you a particular favourite as a weapon?
Yes, I think everybody liked the Tommy gun, the Thompson submachine gun, as it was properly called, later become the Thompson machine carbine. But the Tommy gun was issued to us during our desert days, and all patrol leaders opted for a Tommy gun. It was a short-barreled weapon, nice and conveniently handy to use at close quarters. Also carried a magazine of 28 rounds, where the rifle only carried 5, one up the spout making 6 in all. I've always considered the 38 pistol as a purely ornamental type of weapon. It certainly doesn't stop a man running towards you. So a Tommy gun was a favourite weapon.
It mustn't have been a very pleasant episode, Mr. Hawksworth. Were you frightened by what was going on and what was happening to you?
Yes, it was a bit disturbing. Up to that time, certainly since the outbreak of war, when we were put on the war footing, I'd been working, reading, close proximity of the other stretcher bearers in the section, when we become a small happy band, well used to each other's company. This new development meant that I'd be leaving for parts foreign to me, as far as that was concerned. And I was fortunate in one respect that during the course of the weapon training course I'd been previously attended, I'd made friends with Corporal Fishwick, who had been one of the instructors. So at least going to this new company, I went with somebody, or went to somebody I knew. In fact, I joined his platoon. So all in all, it turned out to be a major development as far as my army career was concerned.
Was there a period of some disillusionment when you had been in charge of something you hadn't done?
Well, I think it was natural for me to adopt a rather hostile attitude towards the authority at that time, until I realised, having spoken to other people with more experience about these matters, that I wasn't the first one who'd been mistakenly walloped inside for something I'd never done. And so, gradually, as I entered into the spirit of the thing in this new environment in a rifle company, and got busy, I put it all behind me.
You now change your role from first aid and stretcher bearer to a rifle company. How did you take to that?
Well, it became sort of natural. As you heard previously, we've been trained in weapons in a long time ago on boy service in far off China, so that side of the training area and situation area didn't come new at all. And having just completed a brand new course, we were top grade as far as that was concerned, with in company and knowledge. As far as settling in with the men was concerned, the rest of the company, I knew most of them personally anyway. So it was just more or less moving from one area with my kit to another and starting a new lease of army service.
Who was your company officer, commanding officer?
Topper Brown, Major Brown, was the officer commanding, an ex-company sergeant major who'd been commissioned.
What was he like?
Oh, good chap. He was a good chap. He knew all about it. He'd come through the ranks, ridden to the, got his majority, got a rifle company to command, and not much passed unnoticed as far as Topper Brown was concerned. He was a good chap and a popular man.
How was the company organised?
In the usual fashion, there were a small company headquarters consisting of the company commander, the 2IC, company sergeant major, and the CQMS, and two or three odd bods, company clerk and a runner. And the remainder of the men were dispersed into three rifle platoons of some 30 men in each, approximately, with similar weapons, the brain gun sections and the riflemen. And of course, the additional stretcher bearer from whom I've been recently divorced.
Did you go to one of the platoons?
I was sent to the Corporal Fishwick's platoon. I can't remember for the life of me what number it was, but I think it was 7. I think it was 7 platoon. I won't be sure.
How was the platoon made up? Ranking officer and so on?
Well, the normal establishment of the A rifle platoon, as they're known, consists of a platoon commander of lieutenant rank, the platoon sergeant, who answers to the platoon commander, and each rifle section, the three rifle sections of the remainder of the men, each consisting of about 10 men, commanded by a corporal, with a light machine gun group as part of that section, consisting of the lance corporal in charge, the brain gunner, and his number two.
Do you recall who commanded your platoon?
No. No, I can't recall him.
What was your role in the platoon?
Well, since I'd just been promoted lance corporal, I was in charge of the light machine gun group with the brain gunner and his number two.
How did that function?
Well, each platoon, having three machine gun sections, were responsible for supporting fire on active operations, covering fire from the flanks, according to the book. On numerous occasions, of course, in operational situations, the brain group would become detached from the remainder of the rifle section in order to place themselves in a covering fire position. That is why they had a junior NCO in charge of the machine gun group. When it acted solo, there was a commander with it.
The Bren gun, as a gun, what was it like?
Oh, it was the first machine gun of its type introduced into the British Army. We previously had a gun called the Lewis gun, which had many faults, some 23 in all. The Lewis gun up to that time had served a useful purpose, both as a ground roll machine gun and an anti-aircraft gun. But it had, as I said, many faults. There were I remember, some 23 known stoppages on the Lewis gun, and one had to know the lot and the proper system of remedying them. Whereas on the Bren, the only known stoppage was an empty magazine. It became increasingly popular with the men. It was accurate, it was comparatively light, and as opposed to the Lewis gun, which fed ammunition through the positioning of a large flat pan, the Bren had a vertical magazine, extremely slim proportions, which meant that the firer could see more of his target.
You said there was a gunner and his mate. What was his role?
Well, the gunner would obviously lie behind the gun, aim and fire it. And the number two job was to assist the number one in replacing the empty magazines and mounting the gun on the tripod with which it was associated when it was required.
How many magazines would you carry with you, say, into an action situation?
Normally, a box of magazines contain 10 magazines, fully laden, weighed something like 2 stone, with one on the gun. But occasionally, when necessity demanded it, extra magazine would be carried in pouches which had just been introduced to the equipment situation, which were worn on the belt below the chest. They were in fact Bren gun pouches.
What was your role within that small unit? What was your own personal role as the NCO?
Well, my role as the one of the three junior NCOs, Lance Corporals in the platoon, was to look after the general well-being and interest of the other two members of the small section. I was responsible for making sure that the machine gun was in operational action, in state of cleanliness at all times, that the ammunition was clean, and the magazines were discharged and reloaded regularly.
Was there a routine of cleaning the gun every day?
Yes, it was a daily occurrence. The magazines were loaded and unloaded on a rotational basis, so that each magazine was cleaned at least once a week. And great care was to ensure that the ammunition was kept clean, for obvious reasons.
You settled well into the platoon, you said?
Yes, extremely well, quickly.
Currently. Where did you go after this?
Well, we left Malta on... June 1943, we left by sea for Egypt once again. We're becoming quite used to seeing the shores of Egypt by this time, of course. We left by sea in a small convoy of ships with a small naval escort. And I think the second day out en route to Alexandria, just off a mile or two off the African coast, the North African coast, a ship accompanying our small convoy between our own ship and the shore was torpedoed, soon to sink. Although at the tail end of the convoy, a vessel possibly positioned for this very purpose was seen to be collecting survivors using a series of nets overhanging from booms from the side. We later believe that this ship, the one torpedoed, had actually been carrying Italian prisoners of war or German prisoners of war from further up the African coast. So in fact the enemy had sunk a shipload of its own people.
The war in Africa, of course, almost ended, certainly as far as the North African coast went. Were you getting news of the success of the 8th Army?
We were, involved, deeply involved with the 8th Army progress. Our position by that time, we'd been reinforced by air. We now had air superiority over the island. We were no longer bothered by German aircraft. One or two tried to sneak in, but met with little success. And the attitude then was of complete offensive. Swarms of torpedo bombers were brought in. The long-range Spitfires and Hurricanes were operational on a day-and-night basis. And one of the most popular aircraft of the day was brought in to operate as a night protector, the Bowfighter, which proved to be very successful operationally at night, shooting down enemy aircraft. So the island was effectively described as a floating an aircraft carrier to all extent.
And when you left, the siege had been raised.
Yes, we were, if one can so call it, fortunate in the respect that we saw the island under siege, and we also served there not only during the siege but after it had been relieved.
You went to Alexandria, you say. Where did you go to after that?
From Alex, we went up by devious means. Some went by motor convoy. The others went up by troop train from somewhere in Egypt, across the canal at Kantara, up into Palestine. We went up in the Palestine by stages, stopping off here and there and doing a little bit of training. Eventually found ourselves up in Syria.
Your training there, your role had changed now. You were no longer a siege battalion, as you put it. You were going to do something else. How had it changed? What was happening to you?
Well, we were not surprised to be told once again that we were going to be trained in an invasion training. So we were becoming quite adept at this. But this time, it didn't involve beach landings or anything like that. No seaborne operation. It was mountain climbing that and mountain warfare that we were engaged in. And most of the time was spent being supervised by Scottish gentlemen in kilts and hairy moustaches, teaching us how to walk and march up mountains and down again and conserve our strength. This went on for, at least a month.
How do you move equipment up and down mountains?
On our backs.
Everything goes on your shoulders?
Everything was humped. The part where we were operating was somewhere in the vicinity in the Lebanese mountains above Beirut at one time, which gets mentioned these days, and food, ammunition, and all the necessary equipment was man-packed. In fact, we had special equipment introduced about that time called an airframe, which is popular with mountaineers now. Which was a triangular light balsa piece of equipment which fitted to the skeleton braces on the back of a man with a small ledge of something possibly 2 or 3 inches jutting out on which various items were carried, mainly ammunition and rations. After this period of mountain training was completed, we found that we were being moved once again and found ourselves towards the beginning of September at a tented camp on the coast of Palestine called Afula.
Had you any notion where you were going?
None whatsoever.
I hadn't reached a stage in the war where you were actually being briefed well in advance, as it seems to have occurred later on.
No, I think there was all sorts of rumours going around the place. I remember we were in a brigaded camp. Certainly, one of the battalions adjoining was the Royal Irish Fusiliers, who regularly entertained us with their excellent drum and pipe band. But the future destination, if indeed it was known at that time by anyone, was kept a closely guarded secret.